Welcome to the She Negotiates podcast, where we help you claim your value, earn your worth, and smash glass ceilings. Each episode will feature an in-depth interview with an expert on how to negotiate with your doctor, your employer, your children's school, and of course, your family. Tune in to hear great stories and get actionable advice with your host, Victoria Pinchon.
Good morning. You have reached the She Negotiates podcast, and today our guest is Minson Vo. He is currently a freshman at the University of Houston studying business and hopes to turn that business major into an entrepreneurship major. He is a negotiation trainer who helps young adults get what they want in a world full of power imbalances and uncertainty. Negotiation, as he has discovered, sometimes gets too complex for some people to process, and that is why his ideology is to teach the art through the lenses of simplicity, clarity, and efficiency. In the last 18 months, he has conducted at least 100 training sessions, seminars, and private speeches to teens on negotiation. He is currently leading a startup of 7 advised by negotiation experts to expand negotiation to the realm of college entrepreneurship. He hopes that the entity that he and his partners are working on will be officially launched by early 2022. Welcome, Minson.
Thank you. How are you? Much. Thank you so much, Vicky. It's an honor to be on here in this podcast with you.
Yeah, it's great to have you. I want to hear a lot about what you've been doing because you are, for me, definitional of youthful ambition and action. But I was going to ask you, how did we meet? And I remember how we met. Mm-hmm. So I went back in my email and I got your email. And I think that your email, your first email to me, is really, you could deconstruct it along negotiation lines. So here it is. You wrote to She Negotiates. We asked, how can we help you? You said, I hope you and your family are doing well in this time of crisis, because this was in April of 2020. We were in lockdown. I would really appreciate it if you could put some thought into the rest of the email. Okay, I'm thinking. I am a Texas high school student and the president of our high school's negotiation club. We have been meeting every day to study negotiations since the beginning of 2020. While meeting, we realized it would really benefit us, especially as high school students, to talk to a real negotiation expert in quarantine. Please let me know if it is a ridiculous idea for our leadership team, 3 students, to schedule a 30-minute Zoom meeting with you to get an answer to our questions from an expert. Brilliant, negotiated opening, Minson. Tell me how you thought of this. I know you sent this to a lot of other people.
Yeah, thank you so much for that question, Vicky. Actually, one thing that I learned about my generation was brought up to me by my professor who studied my generation, was that we're very proactive. So when it came to negotiation, when I first learned about it, I didn't know where to go. I had no guide, and it was just books and studying random material, random points that didn't really have an order, didn't really make sense. So my friends and I were like, okay, we got to do something. I told them, guys, I'm going to just send emails out to negotiation experts around the world to see if we can meet with them. And that was laughable. I knew it was laughable. I was laughing myself. Like, we were joking, like, oh, this is never going to happen. And then the day after, we got a reply from a professor at Yale, and we got a reply from somebody that was formerly on the FBI crisis negotiation unit. And we were like, oh no, we definitely have some sort of students position that can help us be more persuasive. So we decided to use our resources and reach out to more people using that close to that email format, from approaching from the student perspective, looking to learn, because you have people who send emails are just like, hey, come talk with me. But we were genuine. We didn't know anything. We didn't know what to do. So we're like, we need guidance. And that's how I came up with the idea to send out that many emails. And that's how we met.
Well, that is how we met. And of course, looking back on it now, the fact that you opened and closed by using the term expert, and we're contacting you because you're an expert, and we're high school students, which I think is really, I think was really the most compelling thing that you said, because it seems so ambitious. And I understand you also had a response from the Harvard program on negotiation, right?
Yeah.
So how many experts did you talk to?
I couldn't put a number on it in terms of what or how many came from what university, but I'd say, and this is the crazy thing, people say like cold emails, they have a 1% success rate. Those were all cold emails. And I sent, or my friends and I sent out like 100. Out of 100, about 30 ended up setting up sessions with us. That's a 33% success rate. So it was incredible.
That's amazing. Yeah. So start with telling us what got you interested in negotiation in the first place. You were the organizer of this high school negotiation club, right?
Yeah.
So what sparked a passion in you for negotiation?
Autonomy. Kids my age, especially my generation, we're at a time in our lives where the struggle between independence in the household, especially independence at school, and trying to fit in with what our parents, what our teachers tell us is very strong. So negotiation is kind of a way to mitigate that, I would say, imbalance. Sometimes we feel that at home we have really no, little to no control over ourselves. I mean, what are we supposed to do? Just keep threatening to run away. And at school, it's even worse because you have teachers who, you have a lot of teachers who don't really care about their students. You do have a handful that do care. Those are the good ones. But you have those that don't really care. You got an F, so what? You want to get better in this class, so what? The negotiation was kind of a way to communicate that struggle through the power of influence. It's not like we're manipulating them or anything. We are validating their emotions, helping them feel understood, and helping them slowly, incrementally see where we're coming from. And again, it's really just to not solve, but mitigate that imbalance between the struggle kids my age have for autonomy and our struggle to fit in with what our parents and teachers are telling us as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting, because I never really thought of negotiation as kind of a self-help process. But in fact, what you've just articulated is probably one of the reasons why the women who hire me to help them negotiate compensation and promotions often feel some level of transformation of their ability to deal with everything in their lives when they learn negotiation. So what did you read something? Were you watching a YouTube video? What was the initial spark?
Very specific moment, because I always attribute it to this thing that sparked the entire butterfly effect. It was one school night at 1 a.m., I was scrolling through Instagram. I saw Chris Voss's negotiation masterclass advertisement. The first things out of his mouth were, everything in life is a negotiation. And if I never heard those words, I would have never gotten to where I am today.
I love that. I love that. So at the time you were a teenager, so teenagers scrolling Instagram isn't just bad for teens, right?
Yeah, no, it wasn't bad. And after I watched his keynote, I got his book, and I liked more books and experts. Yeah.
So then you had the chutzpah to start a business with your friends. This wasn't just a high school club. This turned into essentially a startup. Tell us about how that came about.
Yeah. So the business thing was absolutely just because we had a lot of time. We had nothing to do. We wanted to experiment to see what it was like. And we went into it without knowing anything about business, which if somebody older was doing it, should probably never do. But we were young. We were in high school. We had less risk. We didn't have to pay taxes. So we started it with the purpose of teaching negotiation to teens to help them. But going on a few months in terms of researching and designing the website, we realized that for teens, we could just give them the service for free through the negotiation club. And instead, we targeted our focus toward parents. Now, we weren't coaching parents on how to be better parents. We were coaching parents on what needs to happen for them to communicate with their teens. Because we knew that teens like us had very special needs coming into the 21st century with the social media age, technology, and the rise of all these companies. So that went on for that went on until spring of 2021, and it was just, I wouldn't say it was a business as in we're trying to make profit, break into the market, create a big surge in revenues. We were just trying to have fun, and it was the right time for it because who cares if we succeed? Who cares if we fail? I mean, we got to talk to people. We got to talk to parents. We got to speak. And we're still living in our parents' home. So we have our parents and school system to back us up if, let's say, we wanted to dissolve it. So that's essentially a short story of business.
And I think I remember that there was a point. So you created a website, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you created some teaching materials that you put onto the website?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and then you wanted to generate people coming to the website and using your services. And I think I remember there was a point in time where your group decided, oh, we need marketing advice, right?
Yeah.
There was... Okay, so we talked to experts all across the world about negotiation, but now we need marketing advice. And so what did you do to cross that river?
Interestingly, this is probably wrong, and marketing experts would probably not like this. I just told my team that marketing was just asynchronous negotiation. So we thought of it as that. And what we did was we did a research phase, and we marketed on LinkedIn, Instagram, and Facebook. We didn't, again, back then, we didn't really know much, so we just did what other people did and said it worked for them. But I think the main surge of traffic that we got from marketing was, like the negotiation expert thing, contacting big organizations. And we had this phase in December and early January, where we reached out to around 30 to 50 organizations that had parents as their audience, but didn't deliver the same service that we did. So because of that, we were able to form partnerships with these organizations. We set up some professional speaking events with them, got a huge flow of parents coming in, and that was our unexpected marketing.
I love that. I so So how is the business going today?
We decided to dissolve it in May because we are focusing on a new niche, which I don't know if I should disclose yet, but this new entity is focused toward an existing market that we've tested in college entrepreneurship. College entrepreneurs that want services for their startups, but don't really have the funds necessary to pay for them yet.
Oh, that's great. So, so you're in business school, essentially. You're taking business courses, right?
Yes.
And so you must be surrounded by a lot of people your own age. And my sense of people your own age is that there's less of an emphasis on, you know, joining a corporate entity at the end of college and more of an emphasis of starting your own business. So are you tapping into students at the University of Houston or is that kind of part of your market?
Yeah, we're definitely tapping into it. And really, with business, yeah, a lot of people in my generation, they have that misconception that all businessmen are evil, right? Especially, yeah, all businessmen are evil. So I don't tell people really that I run a business. If they ask, I might disclose the information. But at most, I'd say I'm leading a startup that helps other startups. And I just like give my little 1-2 sentence pitch. I'd be like, okay, yeah, so we're targeting students there.
So great. Have you, so you haven't put up a new website? You haven't created the kind of bones of the new business yet?
We've done the research. We finished the pre-seed phase. Now we are approaching launch. We are in, I guess everything kind of goes back to this being proactive or reaching out thing. One of the people that we reached out with, last year, I can't really disclose his name as of yet, but he's a world famous negotiation expert, teaches negotiations at one of the Ivy Leagues, and he decided to become our advisor. So right now we're currently negotiating a deal with him. We're getting that contract closed. And after that, the funding, the equity will be agreed on as well. We're going to incorporate, get shares, divide it up. And yeah, I think that's...
Yeah, this is... when I was a freshman in college, I was waiting on tables in a Chinese restaurant and trying to learn how to use chopsticks. So, you know, you and your group continue to wildly impress me. Tell me a little bit about the cross-cultural challenges that you've had to master as being the first generation born in America. Tell me a little bit about your background and your parents' story.
Definitely. Oh, if I were to tell the whole story, it would take off forever. But I mostly know from my mom's story. My dad, he came over, I forgot what year, but I know it was probably the 1980s, somewhere around there. But my mom, her story is the most interesting because if we go even more down the generation, my grandpa and my aunt escaped after the Vietnam War. I'm going to say it was during the fall of Saigon, but I'm not exactly sure. I just know that it's around that era. And what they did was they got on a ship with a bunch of other people, and they were navigating through the stormy seas. And eventually, the ship started sinking. So an American rescue helicopter came and got them out of the water and the storm. And I can remember my aunt telling me this and me just sitting there. I was like, what? I was so shook. I didn't know I had this family history. And what happened was after that, I don't know which country was first. I believe it was Hong Kong first. They went to Hong Kong. They lived there for 3 years. Then after that, they were taken to a refugee camp, I believe, in the Philippines? Yeah, not entirely sure. But they lived there for, I think, a year or two as well. Then after that, my grandpa and my aunt moved to America. About within the next couple decades, my aunt, my other aunt, and my mom and my grandma came over to America as well. So there's this big struggle in the family after the Vietnam War and this long period of separation before we got reunited. And that really affected those experiences, I think, really affected the way my mom thinks and how she runs the household and the value she puts up for herself and me and my brother.
And what did your parents do to establish themselves? I'm assuming they came to Houston, Texas?
Yeah, I believe they met in Houston, but if not, they met in Vietnam. But yeah.
Yeah, you'll have to ask them. You'll have to get your family history again.
and my dad, he just came over like normal. So he doesn't really have the experiences to really, or the same experience. He has other ones that shape his values.
It's not as dramatic on your father's side.
Yeah.
So they came here, did they speak English?
No. My mom didn't know any English. My dad didn't know any English. They had to work part-time jobs while learning sort of the English on ad hoc and just learn as many words as they could. But eventually, now, of course, they could speak English. They didn't really have
a normal. And did they pursue an entrepreneurial path? Were you inspired some by what they did in order to establish themselves financially in the country?
My mom did, but it's been very recent, like past 7 years. So before that, they would all just work part-time jobs and eventually got a full-time job at companies. But my mom's business, it did inspire me to an extent, but really it's just a mode for just staying financially stable and living. For me, business is much more than that. It's about contribution. So yeah, it inspired me. And also my mom, she has a lot of experience. So she would be giving me all these tips on how to deal with customers. One thing she told me very early on was that your reputation is your most important asset. And I just always taken that to heart. So even though it's not a direct inspiration, I can attribute a lot of the values I get in business to how my mom operates hers.
So when we were first talking about negotiation and the kinds of problems that teens had that you and your teammates wanted to address, I remember some conversations about cross-cultural communications, because I remember saying to the entire team that it was a skill that you had developed since your childhoods, kind of translating between your parents' culture and American culture. Tell us a little bit about that, what it's like growing up as the child of immigrants to America.
So just to clarify, you're talking about specifically the communication challenges with it?
Yes.
Okay, great. I was actually talking, this is very timely, I was actually talking to one of my professors really recently about this specific topic. And the thing that really shapes communication, I'll cover the dynamic first, and really shapes the communication barrier is the values, the ethics, and the way society is structured. In Vietnam, like in the past, we have a very hierarchical society. In America, we do as well. But let's say if you're working if you're a cashier at a restaurant and an old man comes and yell at you, you would be, even though you probably wouldn't do it, you would probably be more inclined and feel more free to do it in America than you would in Vietnam. In Vietnam, if you did it, you would probably damage your reputation forever because he's an elder. You're supposed to respect him. So those kind of dynamics really affect the communication. In terms of values, in Vietnam, we really, nothing is more important to us than family. So politics, we might be strong in it, especially the Vietnamese culture in America. But even if there's a disagreement in politics, we don't let that compromise our family bond. It's super, super important to not just stay connected with your friends, but stay connected with your mother, your father, because they're supposed to be passing down wisdom. And you can really start to see how this would affect, or this would cause conflict with my generation's American culture, because we want freedom. We don't want to always accept advice. We don't want to always respect elders that disrespect us. We don't think it's right. So it's really this shift. But if you look deeper into what's going on, all the parents are trying to do is they're trying to preserve their culture, and just they follow the values that they've learned their whole lives. So we have to be sensitive of that. And us, we're just trying to execute what we learn from the values that shape our lives in America. So it's just these clash of values cause these clash of perceptions. This clash of perceptions cause miscommunication.
So are these clashing values something that is part of the way in which you help young people, either with the conflicts that they present to you or with something much bigger, which is what you're doing now, helping people learn how to, I guess, pitch their startups and negotiate the early contracts that will put a little money into their coffers?
Now, the startup thing is easy because we're only targeting American startups for that reason you just mentioned. But with advising other teens with East Asian parents or Southeast Asian parents or any Asian parent, African parents as well, they have sort of similar values, Hispanic parents, there's always going to be conflict in the way they communicate. So when we give them advice, we make sure that we're sensitive, really sensitive to what are their parents' perceptions on what's going on. What do they feel? And the main thing is just framing it in a way that lets their parents save face, that lets their parents feel like it was their idea, it aligns with their values. But also something underlying is that they have to find ways to reduce risk. You can't tell your father or your mother that their values, their cultural beliefs are wrong and your beliefs are better. You have to find a way to frame it for their beliefs because it's about them. And at the same time, you have to really take small steps to make sure that the risk isn't too much. For example, I can't tell my mom, next year, I'm going to go study abroad. I want to go study abroad. That's too big of a step. I would have multiple conversations with them. And down the line, I would slowly introduce that topic. I would slowly ask her, okay, what would it take or how can we ensure that I'm safe? When you envision that you would let me move out, why would you do that at that certain time? And slowly, yeah, being incremental, reducing risk. Slowly building up to that, so let them save face.
So it would have been useful to have you around during my generation when I was your age, because my generation was pretty much telling our parents that all their values were wrong and that we knew better, and it wasn't good for anyone. You gave me a question so that we could give our listeners an idea about how you do what you do, which is your parents are not letting you X. What do you do? I can give you one that that I had in probably when I was exactly your age, which was I went to go to San Francisco with my boyfriend. And I knew what kind of response I was going to get to that. So I just created an elaborate scenario that had something to do with visiting my father, who was not living with us. So lying to your parents is, I'm sure, not one of the things you counsel your clients to do. So let's just say your parents are not letting you take a trip with your boyfriend. What do you do?
All right. Great question. Thank you so much, Vicky. The first thing we have to do is we have to identify what's really going on. What's the real problem? Like, some parents, they do let their, or they do let, would let you visit your boyfriend. But some parents in the same situation would say no. So we look deeper. The key factor, the key motivating factor is that they probably want to reduce risk. Now, there may be other factors as well. Like, did your parents like your boyfriend? Do you have a good relationship?
Yes, but we're talking about a generation in which being a virgin until you were married was a big value. And I suppose the risk that you would identify would be the potential to get pregnant before you finished your college education.
So it wasn't a safety risk.
It was a moral, religious, and I think probably unintentionally getting pregnant is a safety risk.
Unintentionally. Yeah. All right. So, the real problem is reducing risk. And going deeper into that, some of the assumptions people make are, oh, I know what they're thinking. They just want me to... let's just say, I'm just going to take what you said. They just don't want me to get pregnant. But what if safety is also a factor in that? What if their income at the moment is also a factor in that? What if the news at the moment was also a factor in that? So there's all these assumptions that we have going on, and we really need to identify them. And going into the actual negotiation itself, or pre-negotiation, the first thing is, this is cliche, preparation. And if you're going to prepare for that, it's probably going to have to happen a few weeks out. Because to reduce risk, you have to take it step by step. So you would kind of broadly identify when you might talk to them and future sessions that you might talk to them in. And very importantly, the environment that you would talk to them in. Because people don't know this, environment has a different effect. If they're in the kitchen, they're trying to cook, and you're talking to them, and they're facing away, they're trying to make you dinner, it's not going to have the same effect as if they were laying on their bed, on their phone, bored, having nothing to do. That's one thing that's really important to identify, in addition to setting up or having an idea of what sessions you're going to set up. Other thing that I would just like to add in here is coalitions. I don't know if you had them available at the time, so that's why I didn't ask. But family. What I would do if there were family around is I would call them and I would introduce to them the subject. I wouldn't be like, hey, I need you to persuade my parents. I just talk with them. I tell them my thoughts. I tell them what my parents are doing. And what that's doing, or what those three things are doing, is A, giving you a plan to reduce risk by setting up a lot of mini sessions instead of one big one. B, making sure the environment operates in your favor, or at the least doesn't operate against you. And C, having a support system in case things don't really work out. So you have those third-party influencers. Diving into the negotiation, the first thing to do is to seek first to understand. So Stephen Covey, his book, 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, he talks about this. Most people my age come in trying to explain. And it is the worst thing ever because, like Ronald Reagan said, if you're explaining, you're losing. You're not getting any information. You're not hearing about their values. So I would advise to first come in with an open mind, with questions prepared, asking about their values, their beliefs, why they would have the values or why they have the values, the beliefs they have. And I would constantly try to label their emotions, demonstrate that I understand their perspective, but not also go in there just like having them super confused about what's going on. I would tell them at the beginning, hey, I know that, or I want to bring up a very sensitive topic with you. I know that we might, our emotions might get heated in this moment. You're my mother. I'm your son. I really want us to collaborate. So if we could just put our differences and perceptions aside and talk with each other. And that kind of diffuses the situation, because that specifically goes back, or for your situation, it'll probably diffuse it since you're Caucasian. In my situation, it'll probably diffuse as well, but there's another layer below that, which is going back to the Vietnamese culture, and that is acknowledging that family is the most important thing.
Yeah, yeah,
and
I hear that.
That really puts it aside. But after the empathy, demonstration of empathy, then it would go into problem solving. I think, yeah, this is personal opinion. I don't know if any Harvard people are going to listen to this and batter me. But the Harvard methodology, the principle-based negotiation, it's good. It's just people use it at the wrong time. It's too logical. First, you really have to deal with emotions. And then you can really get into what does she need? What does she want? And this is assuming that you're persuading your mom. Or what he needs, what he wants, if you're trying to persuade your dad. And you would try to set up a collaborative environment. In my team, mm-hmm. we always say that cooperation or influence is a balance between collaboration and assertiveness. So not just assertiveness, we need to make them feel like they're part of the process. And if you're trying to negotiate with both parents, I would advise that you don't do it separately. Now, this could sound very counterintuitive to what most people do. It's, why would I negotiate with both parents at once? They'll just batter me. Well, you have to be transparent what you're doing. You start the conversation, hey, I know you guys both disagree with me. You guys don't like what I'm doing. You guys think that what I'm doing is unsafe for myself. And then they'll open up and listen. And what that does, having everybody there, it prevents miscommunication. Last thing is implementation. This is what derails almost every negotiation that I've advised teens on, and is that our generation makes very informal, soft commitments. I invited 7 friends to an event the other day, and 6 out of them dropped out on the day of. It's terrible. But we make very soft commitments. So I have to tell people to, or like in those situations, okay, let's say they both agree. Who's going to do what? What's going to happen? When is it going to happen? Where is it going to happen? How is it going to happen? What happens if the day you decide to go and a storm comes in? What's the backup plan? And at the end of that, how is it going to, or what other obstacles might get in the way? And finally, you would summarize everything. Make sure that implementation is bullet by bullet to make sure that you actually turn agreement into action. And that's what I would.
That's perfect. I don't think that that's contrary to the Harvard program on negotiation. What I hear you saying is that they don't appear to take the emotional content of the negotiation into consideration. I think that might be emphasized, you know, they could emphasize that more. What I hear you talking about is emotional intelligence and cultural understanding as part of party interests, because, you know, having come from the legal field myself and having spent about a decade helping lawyers settle litigation, I would have to remind the lawyers that what the dispute was about was fairness, that they're participants in the justice system, because most lawyers think of cases being, quote, money-only cases. And the way I was trained by the Pepperdine Dispute Resolution Program was, you know, there is no such thing as a pure money case, and that there's always an emotional element to it. And I also found that as a mediator, mm-hmm. it was when we finally tapped into someone's emotion, which is contrary to the whole legal project, yeah. which is to remove emotion so that you can have precedent, you can have some level of certainty about under these circumstances, regardless of how people are feeling about it, this is the result. So, so that's a problem that will continue to be worked out between lawyers and conflict resolution people probably for the next 50 years. But Minson, I want to thank you for writing this crazy email to me and for doing what you're doing. I hate to sound like Miss America, but I do think that this is the way we will someday, in some unimaginable future, have world peace, particularly as we have diverse cultures coming together and the practice of understanding them first being the beginning of the diplomatic response to any kind of conflict, whether it be between countries or teens and their parents. So, as you know, I will continue to follow you. I'm very excited to hear about the startup project. I have people you should talk to and who are in that area. And tell our listeners how they can find you. Where are they going to find you when you're doing the startup advising?
Where are they going to find me when I'm doing the startup advising? I can't release the name of the startup now. We do have the name in check, but okay. LinkedIn would be the best place. Just search up Minson Vo, that's MINSON space Vo on LinkedIn. And in about a few months, you should see the website, the name of the organization up there.
Oh, great. That's very exciting. Good luck in your, I think you have finals coming up, midterms. Okay. Well, good luck in your midterms. It's nice to see students back in the classroom. And great talking to you. Thanks for coming on to the She Negotiates podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Vicky.
You're welcome. Okay.
That's it for this episode of She Negotiates. If you liked it, be sure to subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts, and please leave us a rating and review in Apple Podcasts. Thanks so much for listening, and until next time, remember, the world needs what you have to offer. All you have to do is ask.